She's Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahavivyankaravavahai Tejasvinavaditamastu Mavidvishavahai Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
So, thus the sufferings of the individual spirit souls are caused by the soul's misidentification with the material body. When the bonds of that misidentification are cut, then the soul attains liberation. To reveal this truth, the author of the sutra speaks the following words. Sutra 19. Because it restores the soul to its original nature, renunciation of materialism brings liberation. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Misidentification with the material body places a soul in an inauspicious condition, a condition that breeds worthless material desires. By renouncing those material desires, a soul becomes free from the cycle of repeated birth and death. This is so because by that renunciation, the soul attains its original nature, which is spiritual and full of bliss. That is the meaning here. This is described in the following words of Taittiriya Upanishad 2.4.1. Quote, O saintly one, a person who knows spiritual bliss never fears. In Sandilya's Bhakti Sutra 2.3.2.93, it is said, the soul is both one and different from the Supreme. When he is freed from the material body, the soul is glorious like the sun. In the Katha Upanishad 1.2.17.18, it is said, taking shelter of the Supreme is the most auspicious activity. Taking shelter of the Supreme is the most auspicious activity. One who takes shelter of the Supreme becomes glorious in this world. For the soul there is neither birth nor death, nor having once been does he ever cease to be. He is unborn, eternal, ever-existing, undying, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Right, so in the Gita, then we have Krishna saying this, right? Who is the creator, who has made everything. So his saying this statement would be very authoritative. Now this is someone else speaking. Who would be speaking here that by them saying this, you would know that it must be true? Right? Who is speaking in the Katha Upanishad? We came across it before. No one remembers? Yep, it's Yamaraj. Right? So all he deals with is death. So he knows the soul never dies, right? Because if the soul died, then how would he punish them, right? Because they've given up the one body, but because they're still there, then he's able to punish. So he knows more than anybody that you're not this body, right? Because that's all he deals with, is making new bodies for the living entities and watching them give up old ones. Okay? Then Katha Upanishad 1.2.6, Yamaraj says, fools intoxicated by wealth say this world is all and there is no other. These fools will not be glorious in their next birth. Again and again they will come under my grip. In the Katha Upanishad 1.2.9, it is also said, O dear one, the truth cannot be known by material logic. It is known only by learning it from a self-realized soul. Because you are sincere and determined, you have learned the truth. O dear Nachiketa, I pray that my other disciples will be like you. The words of the sages are our bridge to understand the truth. In the Mahabharata, Bhishma Parva, 5.22, it is said, anything transcendental to material nature is called inconceivable, whereas arguments are all mundane. Since mundane arguments cannot touch transcendental subject matters, one should not try to understand transcendental subject matters through mundane arguments. Right? So there's the point is the spiritual has been made, the point has been made. Then there's the tendency is as if one is analytical, the example given, one will try to find an exception to that example. Right? You give an example to show the point. Then you will find an exception to that example that was given. So what would that be called? Right. What is this process here? What's the purpose? Yes, it's fault-finding. Because why is the person giving the example? Is the example the important point? No, they're trying to establish a point. They're using an example to show how it can be established. Because you have a point, but that point is going to be esoteric. That point then has to be shown in a form that we can relate to. Right? Therefore, you give an example according to the audience. Does that make sense? So this esoteric principle that you're discussing, you know, like God's greatness or something, so you have to show something in this world because God's beyond material logic. But you may give an example within the sphere of people's perception to try to show that truth. But because it's coming in parampara, the material example also carries the spiritual potency. So even though it's not technically the example that's giving you the realization, it's the potency within that example. Does that make sense? So that way then one can start to see within one's material mundane existence the Lord at every step. Because he is there. But it's not through material logic that you're going to see he's there. Right? So then by trying to find the fault in the example, then it means I'm not actually trying to apply that knowledge. I'm simply interested in mundane argument. Right? I may also like conclusion, but I have a lot of fun, you know, just harassing people and, you know, showing how intelligent and clever I am that I could come up with some example. You know what I'm saying? Or some exception. Right? Because there's always an exception. That doesn't mean the rule doesn't apply. Right? All stool is impure. If you touch it, you have to take a bath. But cow dung is not. All bones are impure, but conch shell is not. So this idea is that, well, if I find an exception, then everything goes out the window, but it doesn't work like that. No, you find an exception, there are exceptions. Right? You know, what is it? I goes before E except after C. So it's always before for E. But if there's a C, then it's. So it works like that. There's always going to be the standard rule, and there's always going to be a few exceptions. It's the way life works. There's the way you normally do things, but there are some situations where it's a little different. Does that make sense? So that's why mundane logic can't actually get you anything. So people are very intelligent, right? Like a good example is modern academics. Because they're so intelligent, they think they know everything. Therefore, if you give them something that doesn't make sense to them, then it can't be logical. It can't be intelligent because they are the only intelligent person. Right? This is the problem. They can't understand the Vedic culture, this, that. Therefore, it can't be something very developed. It has to be something foolish because they can't understand it. Right? So this is a natural example of this. At the same time, that's just dealing with the gross or the subtle. But that dealing with the spiritual, you have those in the Vedic culture who know the Shastras well, but who are attached to the rules and regulations. So they are unable to understand actually the spiritual that's behind it. So they don't understand what is the cause of the form that they're able to perceive. Does that make sense? So from the gross to the subtle means some are gross, they can't understand subtle. Some can understand gross and subtle, but can't understand spiritual. So the mundane intelligence and logic can only get one maximum up to the subtle. They can't get one past that. They can't get you to the spiritual. Therefore, it's being said here is that the soul, then, when it's restored to its original nature by giving up the mundane identification, then they are going to actually, come to the proper platform. That will give them liberation. Right? So he's saying here, worthless desires, everything must be given up. Now, the whole point is this, how is this giving up going on? This is a very important point to understand. This can be, means the principle is very simple, but in application, there's some considerations that if that's not understood, there'll be problem, right? So that means, it says here, material breeds worthless material desires. So that would possibly indicate that there are worthwhile material desires, right? Or it means that all material desires are worthless, okay? So how would you reconcile that? It means all material desires are worthless, so therefore, how are you going to get to the spiritual platform if you can't renounce immediately, right? Remember, this is Upanishad. So therefore, they're going to work on the principle anything mundane is worthless. Right? But most people aren't situated on the platform of the Upanishads. Philosophically, yes, but in their lifestyle, not necessarily. Right? So then, how would that be applied? How would, because this is, we have here Yamaraj, a Grihastha, talking to Nachiketa, who's a Brahmachari, who's graduating. Right? They're going to work with them. So that means then there must be worthwhile material desires. So what makes a material desire worthwhile?
As in pursuance of achieving realization.
Yes. In other words, if it's in connection with Krishna, then only it's worthwhile. So what's the worthwhile part?
Connection.
The connection to Krishna. So if that's understood, then we can understand how to apply this. Because one must come to the realization that all material desires are useless. So what material desires are important to you that you can't put into that category of useless and then move on from them, they must be made useful by connecting to the Lord. Right? Then by connecting those to the Lord, then you are still establishing your proper identity. Right? Because the point is that by the material, the living entity, because of misidentification with the material body, like that, then he is entangled. So if he doesn't identify with it, then he's not entangled. Therefore, if he identifies as Krishna's servant, he is conditioned in this way, therefore he's in this situation. So those desires must, as a servant of Krishna, be connected to Krishna. Then your sambandha is right. Your abhideya is right. Your goal is for Krishna's pleasure, is right. But the quality of what you're offering Krishna, the quality of what you're rendering, is not so great. But still, it's connected to Krishna. Does that make sense? So that's the point, is that then it becomes worthwhile, because the identification is correct. Therefore, your activities will be correct. If your identification is connection with Krishna, the results of activities are for Krishna, that means your activities will be correct. So in principle, it's situated on properly. So that's what would be Krishna is talking about, properly situated. It doesn't mean that one doesn't have material desire and is not dealing with it. It means one's properly situated. Right? That's Krishna's point about the person being a sadhu. Right? Because he's properly situated. Why? He identifies as a servant of Krishna. He knows the results of his activities are for Krishna. But the activities he may be performing may not be ideal. But he still sees things in connection with Krishna. Therefore, why he won't be a saintly person? Does it make sense? Right. In Sri Vyasadeva's Vedanta Sutra 2.1.11, it is said, transcendental topics cannot be understood by argument or logic. In Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.21, Sri Suta Goswami explains, thus the knot in the heart is pierced, and all misgivings are cut to pieces. The chain of fruit of actions is terminated when one sees the self as the master. Okay. Liberation is described in these words of Srimad Bhagavatam 2.10.6. Liberation is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle material bodies. Right? It means that he's giving up those. So if you still want to be the controller and enjoyer, that you won't be able to leave the subtle body. It means maybe temporarily, but the problem is as soon as you want to do something, then you're going to need you know, a subtle body to, you know, appreciate these things with. The mind will have to be active. And with the mind's active, then to attain that, you have to have a gross body. Therefore, they've never permanently given up. It says, liberates the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle bodies. Right? So, wording is such as that you will catch it that you could consider it to be the Brahman, because you're only going to look up giving up the changeable, gross, and material. But he says the permanent situation of the form of the living entity. Right? So the living entity's form, having given up the subtle and gross material bodies, that is the permanent situation. That's liberation. Does that make sense? So giving up the gross and subtle bodies of this world, taking up the spiritual form, one's natural spiritual form, that is the permanent situation that is therefore defined as liberation. Right? Anything less than that's not actually defined as liberation. Does that make sense? Yes.
Right, there's a book, I think it's called Minor Upanishads. And in the introduction, the scholar translated that. This is something the scholar says. In Vedic times, you had gurus. What they would do to a disciple when he would join the guru group, they would actually kind of uplift him, like make him see that there's the body and he's the soul. This was like the first thing he would do to show him that he's not the body. And then he would realize that. When I read it, I was pretty shocked, because that is it happening nowadays also? How can we get that realization? It's like,
because you're taking it as a mystic thing, but yeah. Gurus aren't mystic. Gurus are spiritual. And the person who's writing this book is mundane. So with his own mundane, it's a proof of this point. Transcendental topic cannot be understood by argument or logic. So the person who's written this book is a scholar. And so, therefore, he thinks he understands it because it's something different. He takes it as some mystical activity, you know, that they're doing. So therefore it's doing. It's a matter of, you just have to simply say, is that, you know, this hand, whose hand is it? You know, that's how you do. So in other words, right in the beginning, they understand they're not the body. You have to realize it, but you have to understand, because he's saying they understand. So realizing is another thing. It's not that you separate it and they can see both, and like this and that, but how do they know what they are? Because they're the soul. Because if they can separate the gross and subtle body, then that's still not the soul. So even if they separate the soul out, how are you going to see 1/10,000th the tip of the hair? And if you're separated from it, you're not in your gross body, how from the soul's point are you going to see it? Because you don't have senses to see it with. So unless he manifests you in your spiritual form and you can still see the material form, then it wouldn't have any meaning. And that's not what the guy's talking about. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, it's just a concoction of his mundane intelligence, how he's trying to work it out and make it special. So one is he has some faith in the Vedic culture, and so he's showing how the Vedic is superior to the modern, in that the gurus before could do that. But at the same time, is they're not doing it now, so therefore he probably takes up a more of a modern lifestyle. Does that make sense? So that's the whole thing, is don't get bewildered by the mystic. You know what I'm saying? Mystical is going on at all times. Like that. Everything's mystical. How is it that, you know, you don't have to think about it and you breathe and your heart works? That's mystical. You know what I'm saying? You get a cut, it heals itself. You don't have to, you know, meditate on it or something. You know what I'm saying? Everything's going on as mystical. So all you have to do is be conscious. And in that consciousness, connect that to God. That's all you have to do. Everything else is mystically taken care of. So you're living in an atmosphere of mystique. So one doesn't have to create bewilderment on top of the metaphysical. Metaphysical is for enlightenment, not for bewilderment. Because bewilderment means the mode of ignorance. So because you can generate the mode of ignorance, you know, consciously generate it, then people think this is very special. Does that make sense? Like that. So it's not actual knowledge. It sounds like it. Most people will think it is. They'll agree, but they're dealing with mundane logic and argument. That's why they can't. They can't. Does that make sense? Okay. Here someone may ask, if it is by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that the individual soul, spirit souls are given independence, and if by exercising that independence the soul finds only suffering, then why is that gift of independence considered mercy on the Lord's part? Right? In other words, who's at fault here? Me or God? You know, if he had created me so I wasn't independent, I would just be God conscious. I wouldn't be here suffering. So it's all God's fault. Right? Ever heard that? Right? So, therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given this point here. So, in other words, see, devotees are using mundane logic to come up with that. Because the point is independence is just is a natural position. If you're not independent, how do you have a relationship? Right? People are happy, husband and wife, they're independent. So they decide to have a relationship. They're happy. They're independent. They decide to have a child or make a house or get money. These are all due to their independence. And it brings about their pleasure. So if from that they get pain from that, now why are they forgetting about the other side? They didn't mind that. Because they're saying is, why did God make us independent so therefore we're suffering? They're not saying, why did God make us independent so we're happy? You know what I'm saying? So the complaint about God's arrangement is only about the suffering part, not about the happiness part. You know what I'm saying? The devotee gets suddenly an inheritance. He gets $1 million from some, you know, aunt he's never heard of and all that. And he gets that, and then he goes out, buys himself a place, sets himself up, gets himself a fancy car, takes his wife out, goes on a holiday. Is he complaining to Krishna? No. But has he remembered Krishna once? Not necessarily. But now if he lost $1 million and, you know, all these different things, then he's complaining to Krishna. Why is this happening to me? I'm a nice guy. I chant my rounds. You understand? So it's all one-sided. It's only the suffering part that we're complaining about. No one's complaining if they're getting material happiness. No one's complaining. Oh, Krishna, this is too much. I'm so happy, you know, like this. My family is going so nice and all that. Why are you doing this to me? Anybody's complaining like that? No. So therefore, it is not logical. You know, that's the problem. Yes. But. Yes.
Why would they complain about the material happiness?
It's why would they? But my point is if you're disturbed about mundane suffering, then that means you're complaining about, you know, the concept of being unhappy, right? And so my point is if it's spiritual, why would you be satisfied with material happiness and only dissatisfied with material unhappiness, right? It means that if you're looking at it from the spiritual platform, both would be a disturbance. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, for the saintly person, if the happiness isn't a problem and we're comfortable like that, then it would be natural that the distress wouldn't be a problem. So how do you know someone's a saintly person? It says they're equipoise in happiness and distress. So when things nice happen to them, great. You know, if things not so nice happen to them, you know, it happens. So they're equipoised in both. But the one is good things happen, they're jumping up and down and, you know, like that. Then when something bad happens, then they're all, you know, feeling very bad. No? Yes? Like that. That's why it's like this. You know, the one is moving like this and the other is moving like this. You know, like that. And that's how they go together. It's like, you know, yeah. You're holding onto a rope and something's pulling off this way, you get pulled a little this way, and then the other goes that way, you pull a little that way. Right? Does that make sense?
Could but you be like really happy when you're happy and not so sad when you're sad?
Couldn't you be really happy when you're happy and not so sad when you're sad? But how would that be a balance? You know what I'm saying? Because you're dealing with something inferior. So therefore, how much happiness can it give you? It means happiness is defined by you think it will make you happy. know what I'm saying? It's not necessarily that it is defined as happiness. Happiness is defined as you obtaining what you want, you call that happiness. You know what I'm saying? So what you define as what you want to obtain to be happy may be very different from what someone else defines. And it may be what they define as their happiness is not yours. You know? So it's very arbitrary. So now the point is then that means each living entity is making up their own standard of happiness. Right? According to their own experience. Right? So, but then if you want actually people to be, that's okay on your own, but the problem is to become happy, you have to interact with others. So then that means they have their standards, you have your standards. Then how are you actually going to be happy? Because you can never actually be happy because your standards are going to be different from someone else's. So, and you have to work with them to get what you want, and they're going to be working to get what they want. You understand? So, how will you actually ever be happy? Really? But if the standard is set by God, right? Because it's art, it could be anything. But so out of all these options, and God says, well, this is the best option. And everybody's working towards that. That means your what makes you happy and what makes me happy and what makes God's happy is the same thing. Right? Then how is it you will not be happy? Right? You will be happy. Right? So that's what's being said. And that's always inside. It doesn't go outside. The thread doesn't go outside of that thing around your neck. Ah. Okay. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Fearing that someone would ask this question, the author of the sutras speaks the following words. Sutra 20. Because of the Lord's mercy, they are independent. The individual spirit souls can turn from the Lord and love others in his place. Means, in other words, in God's place. Commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. To make them powerful and glorious, the Supreme Lord gives independence to the individual spirit souls. Using this independence, the soul may forget the Lord and become attached to the objects of the material senses. That is the meaning. In the Upanishads it is said, quote, entering with the individual soul, I will create the name and form. So, how do you say? Means the Lord is coming. How you say? Means the living entity enters a material existence. The Lord comes with him, and he creates the name and form of everything that the living entity is trying to enjoy. So the living entity still is dependent upon the Lord, but he doesn't know it. That's the illusion. It's not that the living entities in the material world are actually independent from God. They just think they are because they don't see God in anything. But in factual, they're as dependent on the Lord in the material world as the living entities in the spiritual world are dependent upon him. The difference is in the spiritual world, they recognize that. In the material world, they don't. So it's an illusion to think that I'm actually independent. Right? So what is independent is your desire. So we see here. They can turn from the Lord and love. They can love the Lord or turn from the Lord. That is their independence. But in that choice, those facilities will be made by others. So then, within that, the desire is there, right? That's why the field of activities. God creates the field. Then you decide what you want from that field. Then God arranges that you can interact with the field in that way and get the results that you're looking for. Right? So that means the whole field, the activity itself, the result gotten is all arranged by God. So that means he is all those things. Right? So the living entity thinks he's getting some taste from this, from having an identity by looking at the field and identifying with it, by performing an activity that they have qualifications, they have skills, by getting a result that they think, yes, I am qualified, I can get things done. Right? In this way, I'll be happy. So their identity makes them happy, their abilities make them happy, and their results make them happy, but all that's Krishna. So everything that they, in their life, take as important is still Krishna. But they're not seeing Krishna in it, so therefore that's illusion. Right? But what you're dealing with is inferior. It's inferior is dead matter. So it's Krishna has to make the dead matter happen. Does that make sense?
Does that mean there's some can this be seen everywhere from animals right up to God?
Anything. Anything you want to deal with, it's there. You understand? You take an atom, then you have so many parts of it. What's related to who does what and everything, that's sambandha. What activity that atom does and all that, and results of that, then you see your abhidhaya and your prayojana. There's nothing that doesn't work on sambandha abhidhaya prayojana. You want to pick your nose, still sambandha abhidhaya prayojana.
And in the spiritual world?
The spiritual world is the same thing. Yeah, and the results gotten by those activities. But everything there is connected to the Lord. There's nothing that they're not conscious of in connection to the Lord. So that's what makes them special. And the conditioned living entity, basically there's nothing that he does that he thinks of the Lord. Right? But still, everything he's dealing with is the Lord. So the fortunate soul is then the one who is waking up to this concept by the grace of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Then they start to see Krishna in their activities, start to see Krishna in their identity, in their value system, in their activities, the results of their activities. So as the more and more they see this, the more and more they become God conscious. Does that make sense? So the whole idea is that the functioning of Krishna consciousness is working on a very different level. It works perfectly with the mundane, because the mundane is created by God, it follows the laws of God. The mundane follows the laws of God. It's just a matter of if we want to take part or not. So that's then what's going on. So what's actually happening in Krishna consciousness, that you're connecting things to Krishna, that's the Krishna consciousness. The activity is the medium. Right? It's the name and the form. You want to be happy, so then that happiness comes in the name of, wealth, and in the form of whatever form of wealth that you're looking for. Either funny little pieces of paper or plastic or faces on it, and numbers, or gold, or whatever it is that you consider wealth. So that's the form, then that has a name. Then there's the concept. Right? So on all these, then he creates all this, so it's therefore it's non-different from him. It's non-different, at the same time it's different. So that means that's why Shastra seem to be contradictory, because everything is Krishna. The forms that you see, all the some aspects of sambandha, that's Krishna. That he inspires the living entity so that they're not, just dead here. Then that desire comes up. He's Cupid. So that creates that desire. Oh, I want to deal with this aspect of the field. The skill, the knowledge that you require, one, to understand the field and to apply it in action. And the act, then therefore the action and the action itself, the ability to do that action, that's Krishna. And the result that's gotten by the grace of the Lord, by through that activity in proper knowledge of the situation, then is Krishna. You know what I'm saying? So in any of the things, you can look at it from so many different ways. Here is the soul is the one who's trying to enjoy. The name and the form is what is being enjoyed. So therefore the jiva is the taking Purusha, he's taking that what he's creating is the feminine. Because it is energy. But I'm saying, but it's Purusha Shakti, means us. We're acting in that capacity as Purusha Shakti. Is that we're Shakti, but we're trying to be Purusha. that makes sense. Like that. Yes.
Does Krishna have references for what kind of service or way that we're assisting Lakshmi? Does he have preferences for
Preferences for what relationships and or what services we're doing? Naturally, it means best preference is that you're not here and you're in the spiritual world and serving under the eternal associates. But if you're here, that's why the Vedic literatures give preferred activities. You know what I'm saying? So a man wants to be involved with woman, he gets married. Right? That's the preferred activity. Not being married, that's not the preferred activity. You know, in the activity, preferred is that you're sensitive and taking care of them. You're sense-controlled, you're sensitive to their needs, trying to fulfill their needs. That's within the rules. That's preferred. You know, and that the woman should be chaste and this and that, and she should try to be satisfied. Because a man can't satisfy her. He can create an environment in which she can be satisfied. But he can't create the satisfaction. So she has to do that herself. Right? So all these things, you do that, that's Krishna's preference. And it gives the best results. You don't follow that, you're not following the preference, and then you're getting something less. But within whatever is less, then again you can apply the same rules again. So it's just a matter of where is your standard. You know what I'm saying? The guy, you know, instead of his wife, then it's not his wife. But the point is that he still has to apply the same elements of sensitivity. You know what I'm saying? He still, but it's a lower level. What he can get from it is less. You know what I'm saying? Because you don't have the security, you don't have the other things. So therefore, how will he be actually satisfied? Right? Because you're looking for something that's going to last. So it's going to, so everything here is temporary. You know, so you want something that at least lasts a little while here. But the main thing that's eternal is the connection with Guru Sadhu and Shastra. So that element then lasts. So if doing that for Krishna, that element then is going to be there. So that you did it for Krishna, it's on the eternal platform. But what you're working with may be very meager. You know what I'm saying? So what Krishna's preference is always your highest grade of dealings within the material sphere. You know what I'm saying? So the how you say the purpose or the principle, you know, is clear, and the forms, the names and forms that are preferred are clear and of the highest standard. But if not, the principle has to be applied on these lower forms. But the general tendency is someone who would be happy with lower forms generally is not looking for the principle. And someone who can deal with the principle tends to towards the higher forms. That would be the natural thing. But in case if someone's intelligent, if there are lower forms that one is pleased with, point is he still has to follow the principles, the higher principles. That will then bring it naturally up to that higher level. Does that make sense? Yes.
Regarding this question, how much the relationship is from both sides, Krishna and the Jiva, and genuinely understand Jiva has to give up material desires and do yagya to satisfy Krishna. Now that yagya manifests in many kinds of ways, like you're saying that what kind of service does Krishna prefer? How much freedom do you have in this choosing of yagya? Because Varnashram and Kali Yuga is not really clearly divine.
So how do you define yagya? How do you define yagya?
Me.
Because you use the term, so you must have an idea.
Sacrificing for the benefit of Krishna.
Okay. So then that means whatever you're dealing with, that is done as a sacrifice to Krishna. Krishna says whatever you eat, whatever you, you know, give in charity, what's the other one? Whatever you do, then do it as a sacrifice to him. So he's not saying, well, you know, he hasn't said, whether you're doing the Ashrameda, the Rajasuya, or Homa, that, you know, do it as a sacrifice unto me. He says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever, you know, you give in charity, do that as a sacrifice to me. You know what I'm saying? If that's done, then because of that higher perspective that will come, that higher knowledge that comes, then you start to be able to very clearly see what you're dealing with is of less quality if it's not of the recommended standard. If it's not the recommended name and form, then you'll start to see that, you know, what is actually there. Because even in the recommended name and form, it's still hollow. It's only filled with Krishna. It's just the better name and form to be filled up with Krishna. Does that make sense? So that's why whether it's gold or iron, it doesn't actually matter. You know what I'm saying? But iron is better than gold. I mean, gold is better than iron. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, it's a very different perception. But you begin with the name and the form. So, you know, certain names and forms are just the recommended, that's just what you stick to, and all that. And so that is the basic lifestyle. In other words, the recommended is what you want to live. You only apply these principles where there's elements outside that recommended lifestyle that are a disturbance. So then those, you see that in connection with Krishna. And then you start to actually see, well, what is of value there? And then immediately you can see that it's not. You know, now it's just a matter of time and practice to make that become a new habit. Yeah. Okay. In the Mukunda Upanishad 3.1.10, it is said, a person who is pure in heart attains whatever he desires. He enters whatever world he desires. A person who desires auspiciousness should worship such a self-realized soul. Right, so who's pure in heart, they attain whatever they desire, because what they desire is always in connection with Krishna, so it's always obtained. He enters whatever world he desires, because the, you know, world he desires to enter is the spiritual world. If he wants to go somewhere else, he'll go there also. Person who desires auspiciousness, someone who wants to be everything, should worship that kind of person. Someone who's always absorbed in the spiritual. Does that make sense? So the person who's pure in heart, what they do, they get the right result, where they're going is correct, that person is who one should worship. Does that make sense? In the Mukunda Upanishad 3.2.2, it is also said, one who desires material things is born again to fulfill his desires. A person who obtains the Supreme finds that all his desires are fulfilled. All his material desires disappear. Right? Because what is of value in the material desire is actually Krishna. So you attain Krishna, there is no need of any material desire. Because when it's just like this, you have, Krishna says the material world is a spark of his splendor. Right? And he's basically described three chapters of all kinds of things in this material universe. And he's saying that all of this together is just a spark of his splendor. So that means if we're dealing with, you know, a portion of a spark, right, that we call our happiness. So if you can see Krishna, who's Bhagavan, so he is not the spark, he's the full fire. So if you see him, why you care about the form that spark is taken? You know what I'm saying? That's the whole process. You know, it's just like you have this unlimited ocean of the material world. But as soon as one takes shelter of the spiritual master and follows his instructions, it becomes reduced down to the size of a cat's hoofprint. So that means this boat to take you across, a spiritual master that would take you across this ocean, when you reduce it down to the size of a cat's hoofprint, you can just step over it. So the boat remains still on the side. It's not you get in the boat and it goes over there and everyone else has to sit and wait. Well, they said it'll come back this lifetime, you know. But, you know, so it's not. It's just, it's always there. It means everybody can take shelter of that boat, because as soon as they do, the ocean's reduced and you can step over it. Right? So as soon as you connect it to Krishna, then it gets that starts to reduce the actual interest in it. And then one can see it for what it is. that it's just some another bit of mundane matter that's no more important than another bit. You know, why is this rock more important than this rock? Right? Neither are really important, right? You know, so we create due to our illusion that it is important. But then you actually see that importance you gave to it, actually that was Krishna. Right? That importance, because it gave you a sense of identity, or it gave you a feeling of, you know, skill and accomplishment, or a result of happiness, that life is Krishna. Whatever it is that you're feeling in that sense of identity, that's still Krishna. You know, that ability, it's all Krishna. It's not something separate. Then the name and form that you mistakenly thought that was the source of your happiness, you start to see it's not. Understand? So then the material world just basically evaporates. And what you're left with is seeing everything in relationship to the Lord. So therefore, you know, that pillar that was just holding up your ceiling in your house now becomes, it's Krishna's potency holding up the and it's taken the name and form of a pillar in the form of bricks. So you still see it, but the perception is different. So that's the thing, it doesn't change. The activities remain the same. But it completely changes how you deal. Now, it's naishkarma, because now you're doing it as your duty for Krishna. Right? So if you've accepted a lower form, then now you've accepted that lower form. If it's simply because of your own attachment, you could have accepted a higher form but didn't because of your own preference. Now you accept the higher form. Right? Because there's nothing getting in the way. Since it's service to Krishna, or you see it in relationship to Krishna, then why you wouldn't use the superior name and form? But if it's like the superior is not available due to time, place, and circumstances, then it doesn't matter. Now you're dealing with it as this is what's available to serve Krishna, not because of my attachments to it. Does this make sense? Right? Yeah? Yes?
Is it also related to the verse where Krishna says that the wise entities love, or the entities, living entities love for Krishna, and that's transformed into lust?
Yes. Because you think means love is that you know it's Krishna. Lust is that you think it's something other than Krishna. Because love means I am the servant. And so I'm assisting in an activity and a result. Lust means I am the enjoyer of that activity and result. Like that. But that's not the nature of the living entity. The living entity is an assistant. So even if you are the thinking I am the controller and enjoyer, okay, I'm going to do this. But how does it happen? Because the modes of nature allow it to happen. So who's doing it? It's not us. So we're simply assisting in that. You know, the man wants to, you know, be the lord of the world. So therefore, he's going to, you know, create his army. And he's going to then wage war on the next kingdoms. Right? But then the point is that he wants to conquer. Right? So the point is what's the form of conquering? If you want to conquer something, what's the form of it look like in this situation? Right? It looks like an army and you know, military, you know, facility, right? Or political facility, political prowess. So that's the form. But who's created that form? Right? That's been created by God. The concept of it. So the concept of victory and all these things, that's Krishna. Then there's the form of it. Then you take that form and use it to serve victory. So victory is Krishna. That form of that, you know, military arrangement, that's Lakshmi, because it's in the gross nature. And you're assisting that to serve victory. So even the biggest, grossest demon is still serving Krishna. But they have no idea that they're doing that, so they get absolutely no credit for it. That's why Krishna's not disturbed. Why would he be disturbed? They're still interacting with him. But they don't know it, so that's the annoying part. So that's why now if he deals with his army properly, he gets a good result. He deals with it badly, he gets a bad result. Right? It's time to actually be neutral and watch. But he decides, no, we're going to, you know, march in and charge. He's going to lose his army. Why? Because he's going against the laws of God. Right? So even if he's taken this form, he still has to follow God's laws. Right? You want victory in this way, this is the form of it. That's written by God. Right? Therefore, you have to deal with this particular form to get that victory in a particular way. When you're strong, when you're that, you're in the strength, then you attack. When you're not, then you watch. You know, if that's not going to work, you find allies. You know, you find out his enemies. You know what I'm saying? It means I'm on the south of his kingdom, so the person on the north of his kingdom is his enemy. And my ally. Right? Because we both have him as the common. So we can work with them to defeat him. He's in the middle. So if he attacks and I attack, then he's got a problem. Right? But, you know, the guy to my south and the guy in the north's north, then they're the guy in the middle's friend. So then, depending upon who is following the rules and according to their karma, they get the results, and so then they win. So you can't function outside of God's laws. You know, even if they're trying to be sinful, nasty, right, they still have to do it in the same way. Right? Does that make sense?
So is that enjoyment, just that they're cooperating and they're exhibiting that victory or whatever, and is that why the living entity enjoys that situation?
It's because the living entity thinks that by attaining that, I will enjoy. You know what I'm saying? But let's say you have someone like Yudhishthir Maharaj, then he has to go to war. But he's doing that because, you know, a righteous king should protect his citizens and all that. And so they're not being protected by this other person. Therefore, there's a war to establish security for your own citizens. Or if it's really bad, even for the citizens in the next kingdom. Normally, you don't worry about it if the king is managing properly. But if he's not managing properly, his own citizens are suffering. Then the righteous king might go in and have war just to protect the other guy's citizens. Right? If he's in a position to do that. If he's not, he won't. But if he is, he will. Right? So Yudhishthira Maharaj is on the battlefield. His idea is by I follow the rules of warfare, you know, God-given rules of warfare, you know, understanding I'm not the doer, but it's all by Krishna's grace. And the result of it will be for Krishna's pleasure. So therefore, it looks exactly the same as Duryodhana, who is fighting for himself. He thinks he's the great king, and he wants to be in the enjoyer of his kingdom. So it looks exactly the same, but one is completely mundane, one is spiritual. If Duryodhana wins, he's happy, but it's mundane happiness, just that he obtained what he wants. Then the next day he's bored. Now what? You know what I'm saying? But Yudhishthira, he's doing it for Krishna. So, you know, if he wins, then, you know, still the next day there's still service to be done. Right? So there's no problem. And even if he loses, then whatever situation he's in that position, then he'll serve Krishna. So he's always happy. And the materialist, no matter what happens, he's always unhappy. Even if he gets everything, he's still unhappy. He's never satisfied. That makes sense. So it comes down to the identity. You identify as Krishna's servant and act in a favorable way. Therefore, then you're liberated. And you don't, you'll be suffering and mundane. So that definition defines the nature of the living entity. It defines the living entity. How do you say? In material consciousness, and it defines the living entity in spiritual consciousness. Right? So that's all three aspects of the Dasamul dealing with the Jiva. Right? Have now been dealt with by the Upanishad. So the whole point is identity. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. So end here. So that ends. Oh, okay. Now we have tomorrow is any summary of chapter 2, and we'll move on to the knowledge about the material energy.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanandi.
Really determined, you will do it. You know? It's like